This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Sisters and brothers, fathers and mothers, have you heard the word on the street? From Beijing to New York City, it's a number, it's the answer, it's 350.
This is Radio EcoShock on the triple threat: peak oil, climate change, and the crumbling economy. How will you respond? Hear indie journalist Kurt Cobb ask and answer some of the embarrassing questions. We start out with collapse and try to recover, just like everybody else. Our second guest, Carolyn Baker, has already moved into post-peak reality. Her books, her blog, her seminars help people prepare, physically and psychologically, living in the slump and coming out whole. We'll round up with the big cover-up in the North. Canada's oil patch prime minister appoints climate deniers to key research boards, slashes research, and muzzles top scientists. Shades of George Bush. How they keep Canadians and the rest of the world in the dark. That is Graham Saul of Climate Action Network, interviewed by Stephen Leahy. All to 350 tunes. Let's go.
Human beings with eyes that see and ears that come to understand what's long been clear. There's too much carbon in our atmosphere. Too much CO2. Straight up. And the maximum capacity in terms of parts per million climatology is 350.
Friends, our developing predicament is so strange, so new, we hardly know what to think. Forget about answers. What are the right questions to ask? Time after time, Kurt Cobb gets those questions ahead of the curve. Kurt is an independent writer on energy and the environment. Find his features on Energy Bulletin or The Oil Drum and more. Kurt is a founding member of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA. His work is published in Europe as well. Kurt Cobb, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here, Alex.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, too. I've been running a series of interviews about collapse. Scientist Tim Garrett told us about a massive economic breakdown. That might be the only way to save the climate. That was a few weeks ago. And we heard from Keith Farnish in the UK and both Dmitry Orlov and John Michael Greer in the USA. Well, last week, we used a gentle definition of collapse from Dennis Meadows. He said, collapse is a process where things go down out of control, end quote. How do you define collapse?
I'm inclined to use Joseph Tainter's idea of collapse. And Tainter wrote a book in the late 80s called The Collapse of Complex Societies. And he went back and looked at various cultures and civilizations in the past and tried to find commonalities in their collapse. And the thing that he focused on is complexity. So I'm inclined to think about that as well. And so a collapse is not everybody dies, everything's over. A collapse, in his view, is you move from a higher form of complexity to a lower form of complexity. You're simplifying your society, and that this happens because of many variables, one of which would be resource exhaustion or climate change.
Although I have read in one of your pieces a definition that also included an increase in the death rate or something along those lines. Can you tell me about that?
Well, in that piece, I was thinking about what would be a clear marker of decline, of collapse. Because, you know, you can say, well, the collapse has begun because any number of factors, the financial collapse, the leveling of yields in food crops, not so much yields as per capita grain supplies, have not really been growing in the last 20 years. So you could use any index you want. And I wanted to use one that I thought was pretty much indisputable. If you have death rates rising and birth rates are staying steady or falling, then you're going to get a decline in population over time. And it's pretty clear that when that happens, a lot of very big, important, and sometimes catastrophic changes are going to take place in your society. So I was just using that as a marker because we do have someplace in the world today where that's happening, and it's Russia. They avoided a decline this year, but they've had 18 years of decline prior to this. And so although Russia doesn't appear to be in terrible shape, something happened in 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, that was a simplifying event that has created these terrible consequences for the people of Russia, one of which is the collapse of their public health system. So there's a lot of different facets of collapse. You can have a collapse of resources. You can have a collapse that's related to climate change. You can have a collapse that's related to the destruction of certain administrative processes like public health. There's lots of ways that can happen. So that's why I use that example.
Well, the AIDS deaths in Russia and the Ukraine are frightening, and some Americans think that's all in the past. But in a recent news article, I just read that the leading cause of death for African-American women aged 25 to 34 is HIV/AIDS. It's at epidemic levels in the nation's capital. Few of those people have health care. Is it possible Americans could also experience a climbing death rate as the economy deteriorates?
I think that that's likely, and it may not come directly out of the decline of the health care system as we know it. It's probably going to come indirectly through a decline in income and employment among the poorest people in the nation and among people who are currently middle class but lose their jobs and fall into the ranks of the impoverished. That means that their diets are not going to be as good. And that is always something that precedes health problems. If you can't get a good diet, then you're likely to be sick more often. You're likely to have your health decline. So I think that that's an area that we're going to see some problems in health rise. There is, of course, epidemic disease. And to the extent that the federal government and the state governments and local governments can't fund public health measures to contain diseases like AIDS, we're going to see rising infection rates and deaths.
And we're hearing about hospitals closing in Florida just due to economic difficulties.
Right. Well, and hospitals, keep in mind, are the place of last resort for the population that is uninsured. So to the extent that they can't get medical care from hospitals, this is charity care now that's financed by you and me through our health insurance premiums and also through taxation. The government provides some money to hospitals for charity care. If they can't get that care, then where do they go? I mean, they don't have regular doctors. They don't have insurance. So I think this is going to be a real problem as these facilities become few and far between.
Do you think that the U.S. economy, and I guess we could include Great Britain as well, do you think that we are approaching a collapse?
I think that we won't experience collapse as a sort of one-off event. And let me give you an example. We've had this near financial collapse in 2008 and early 2009. Now, the system is still with us. The financial system that essentially brought about that collapse is still with us. And yet, it's in the air that we can't maintain that system. We can't have this system of high concentration of banking power in a few large banks because when they screw up, the whole system can go down. So there's already a move afoot to break up those banks, limit their growth, to regulate them more. And in some ways, when you say we want to break things up, that means you want to reduce their complexity and you want to decentralize. And this is the heart of collapse. I mean, it's moving from high complexity to lower complexity. And I think that we're already on that path. Now, if we were to have some catastrophic economic failure in the future, like the Great Depression, what happened there was suddenly, world trade shut down. And this is the thing that really aggravated the Great Depression, is that people who had formerly relied on trade for their livelihoods simply didn't have a livelihood anymore. And we had systems of trading that, you know, they're going to send us sugar beets and we're going to send them machinery. Well, if that's not happening, where are you going to get your sugar beets? That kind of collapse could be very, very painful. And we'd know it. So I think there's going to be two sort of collapse-type events that occur over time. One will be sort of gradual. We choose to make things less complex because we think that's the right way to go, and others will involuntarily will be forced back on our own resources and a simpler system.
I think one of the things that brings it to my mind is that when I walk through my local mall, there are a lot of shops that are empty now. Things seem to just sort of disappear. Newspapers disappear, or a car company you've had all your life disappears. It's that things going away that surprises us and reminds us that everything isn't going well.
A society is essentially a very complex ecosystem. And if you think of a society as an ecosystem, there are niches, occupational niches, and business niches. And as that society changes, some of those niches disappear. And I think that's what you're seeing, is we've had this tremendous jolt in 2008, early 2009, with the financial collapse. And now we're seeing the ripples of that. And we're simplifying our society. Not every niche is going to survive. Now, what does that mean? That means a lot of people are going to be unemployed. A lot of businesses are going to go bust. And that's a terrible and painful thing, but it's what's happening as a result of this simplifying process, which is, I think, already underway. I don't think that we're, you know, I may have to eat my words in a few years. I don't think we're going to go back to the global economy that we saw in the last decade. I think that we're going to go towards something else, and it's going to be less complex.
So people who are joining the simplicity movement or trying to straighten out their own expectations downward may just be responding in a human way to this larger problem.
Sure. I think that human beings, even if they don't intellectually understand all that's going on in this very complex world, and who of us really does understand the whole thing? That's part of the problem. We don't understand exactly how these systems work, and so when they break down, we don't know how to fix them. But I think there is this intuitive, instinctive sense that one needs to pull back, simplify, change one's life. And a lot of people have been doing that for a long time. I mean, one example that I think is very prominent now is the local food movement, which is really just everywhere. People have known for a while now that we need to do something about our food system. And I think they're doing something very sensible, which is, well, let's make it simpler. Let's make it local. Let's grow some of our own food. Let's have community gardens. And that's a good development. In other ways, we're hanging on to systems that don't work. You know, worldwide car companies. I'm not sure that's the future of civilization, is more automobiles. And yet we've tried here in the United States to revive the U.S. auto industry. I think we could have used that money for better purposes, although, of course, if we had done that, a lot of people would be out of work that aren't today. Of course, eventually, I think they will be. So we're just holding back the flood, and we'll just have a worse flood when the whole thing comes apart. That is the whole sort of what James Howard Kunstler calls the happy motoring culture comes apart.
Well, we'll get to that in just a sec. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Kurt Cobb. Among other things, he's a columnist for the Paris-based science news site Citizen. Kurt, some of us have read The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler or The Long Descent by last week's guest John Michael Greer. You say collapse may not be a smooth downward slope on a graph. It might be ragged and rough. Can you tell us a bit more?
What would be the next crisis and the next crisis? I mean, if you look at the various areas where we have too much pressure on resources, you can predict that we're going to have an energy crisis again at some point. You can predict that we're going to have food shortages again at some point, just like we did in 2008. Whether those shortages are going to be enough to bring the system down, in other words, force it to become less complex, we have to wait and see. But I tend to think that the crises we're going to see in the next couple, three decades are going to be periodic. We'll have a crisis, then we will try to adapt to the conditions that result from the crisis, or we'll try to fix it, and then we'll stabilize for a while, just like we have now. And then we'll face another crisis, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years out, and we will successively try to address these crises, I think partly not understanding that they're part of a greater wave of change, which is forcing us to become simpler in the way that we do things. if we understood that today, I think we could make smarter decisions. But there are vested interests which want to keep us where we are.
And one of those vested interests is each one of us, though, in a way. We want our normal lives to go on with commuters and shopping and paying our mortgage. James Howard Kunstler, in his latest blog entry, remarked on that, how for those of us who have looked at these very daunting problems, it seems surreal that the normal parade should just keep on going. How do you feel about that?
I think there are fewer people who want it to keep going. I think there are people who are questioning whether that system is going to work for them. But consider that they have no alternative right now. I mean, right now, those of us who are aware of the resource constraints facing human civilization, aware of the climate problems facing civilization, aware of the complexity issues facing civilization, we can't step out of human civilization and say, well, we're going to do things all differently over here in my corner of the planet. Because we are all connected to those systems that are currently being used by everyone, that are currently dominant, the global trading system. If I want something here where I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan, I can go to the store and try and find it, and sometimes I can't find it, and I'll have to go to the Internet. Okay, well, this is the worldwide global logistics system, and even most of the stores that are here in my town, they rely on that logistics system. Now, if I go to my local food co-op, I can get some locally grown food because it's available and they've made an attempt to provide it to me. So there are systems that are growing up to replace this global logistical system that we've created, but they are not sufficient to all our needs. I think this is the difficulty that people face when they want to make this transition to a less complex life. A less complex society, is that we have to rebuild all those systems for a more localized existence, and they're not there yet.
I know you have a history in the peak oil movement. Could you tell us, for those few who don't know, how energy supplies could drive us toward a collapse of our present system?
If you think about everything we use every day, everything we do every day, if you have an automobile, even if you ride the bus or you ride the train, you go shopping, get your food, you go to work, and where you work, all the machines are powered by, you say, electricity, but that electricity, almost all of it comes from the burning of fossil fuels. Now, all of those things are going to be affected as oil supplies decline, as natural gas supplies become tighter. Maybe even coal isn't going to be available to us in the quantities that we think it is in the next decade or two. So we can't really disengage ourselves from that system. Let me put it this way. If the energy inputs into all those systems that I discussed is suddenly declining or gone one day, let's say there's a crisis and oil imports are cut off, we'll very quickly be put back on our own resources trying to figure out, okay, how can I get food now that the trucking industry is in crisis and can't ship as much to my locale, now that the transportation infrastructure is in crisis because there's not enough fuel, how do I get to work? We have to start very quickly working out how we're going to do things without those fuel supplies. And that's what I mean by, that's a sudden crisis that would force us to simplify the way we do things. Not a pleasant one, and not one that we could prepare for gradually.
But you and I both know it's not just all about energy. I mean, what about people's belief in the system? That's something that Orlov brings up, that in the Soviet Union, there just came a period where people didn't believe in the whole thing anymore, and that's when it collapsed. What do you say about that?
I'm not sure I would put it that way. I myself was studying in the Soviet Union in 1978. And there were a lot of people that I met during that period that didn't believe in the system then. I think, and by believe in the system, I mean they realized the kind of system they lived under. They realized the kind of censorship they lived with. They realized the kind of regimentation that was imposed on them. And they didn't particularly like it, but they didn't see any way around it or out of it. I think that's the key thing. is when you see a way out of it, and enough people see a way out of it, then things move. And I think that's what's happening in a way here in the United States, and probably to a certain extent in Canada, is people are seeing a way around, for example, the global food system. They're saying, I can grow some of my own. I can have a community garden. I can buy from a local farmer. So that, to me, is the key element. When you see the opening, that's when this kind of change, this kind of phase change in society can occur.
I think that's a good point. Well, along those lines, suppose you had two teenage children, or, you know, 14 or 15, would you try and steer them into college or a technical trade, or what would you advise them?
I haven't had to think about this because I don't have any children, but I think I would tell them to go to college, but also be thinking about starting something themselves, thinking in an entrepreneurial way. And here I'm not thinking about the normal way in which we think about entrepreneurs, which is they have some internet startup and then eventually get an IPO and get rich. That's not what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about, rather than have some complex global organization, whether a large corporation or a large nonprofit that's worldwide, determine your future. Try to figure out how you can create something that's going to function in a lower complexity environment that can provide you with a livelihood and can also provide something of value to the people in your community in that environment. Now, that's not a recipe for getting rich. It's a recipe for surviving and having good relations with your neighbors and having something to do in a society where things are on the move toward simplification. I've been thinking about this myself. I mean, what exactly are the jobs that are going to be available 10 years from now or 20 years from now? It's hard to know if this simplification process continues. You can make some guesses that more people will be engaged in growing food, more people will be providing some kind of craft work, they'll be creating objects that we need in daily life. More people will be involved in repairing things and trying to make them last longer. Those are some guesses, but it's not always obvious, one, what will be available in the way of work, and two, how it will be organized. So I think the people who figure this out first are going to become very important to their communities. They're going to say, oh, this person understands what needs to be done now. So I think that would point the way to a successful life. Not the kind of successful life that we define today as making lots of money, but a successful life in contributing to your community, finding something that you love, being able to do it within the confines or within the context of a rapidly changing society.
Our guest has been Kurt Cobb. You will find his stimulating work all over the net at sites like Energy Bulletin, The Oil Drum, and more. His blog is at resourceinsights.blogspot.com. Thank you, Kurt.
Thanks for having me.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We'll hear more from Kurt Cobb next week on Radio EcoShock. Meanwhile, I want you to hear just a sample from the remarkable end-of-career conversion by Professor David Goodstein. He's the American physicist, until recently the vice provost of California Institute of Technology. Out of the blue, in 2004, Goodstein produced the seminal book Out of Gas, The End of the Age of Oil. Here are just a couple of sample clips of David Goodstein recorded for the film Crude Awakening, The Oil Crash, from Lava Pictures. Get your taste at oilcrashmovie.com or on YouTube.
Everything we read in the newspapers today suggests, at least to me, that the worldwide distribution and production and distribution system for oil is stretched to the breaking point. That the Saudis have promised to increase their production by a million barrels a day. Nobody knows whether they're capable of doing that, and even that is only 1% of the worldwide oil flow. It's really very small. That could be a symptom of being close to this legendary peak that we keep hearing about. In the meantime, there are 1.3 billion people in China. Something like a third of them already have driver's licenses, and most urban Chinese believe that they will own a car within 5 years. It's the fastest growing automobile market on Earth. And so the demand for oil and for gasoline in China is really going to take off in the near future. The price of oil will shoot up, and that will make other hydrocarbons economically competitive. In fact, the oil sands of Alberta are already competitive. They are being mined. But these are not liquid deposits of oil. These are solid deposits. You have to mine 2 tons of ore to extract 1 barrel of a fuel called bitumen. And the bitumen is not rich enough to distill into gasoline, so they have to add hydrogen to it. And so some of the biggest plants in the world for obtaining hydrogen from natural gas, methane, have been built in Alberta. And so your methane, after all, is a fossil fuel. So you're burning fossil fuel to make fossil fuel. And that will become increasingly true as you go down the list of possible hydrocarbons that can replace the oil. In doing that, we're not only using up the legacy that the planet took hundreds of millions of years to gather for us, we're also putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and endangering the future of the climate of the planet. I think we could solve this problem if we tried, but we're not trying. That's why I try so hard to get the message out. You can ignore me if you like and wait for the crisis to come. And maybe it won't come for your lifetime. I can pretty well guarantee that it will come in your grandchildren's lifetime. So if you care about that, then you should be doing something about it.
That was Caltech physicist David Goodstein, filmed for Crude Awakening. Time to move on.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you feeling torn? Part of us wants normal life to continue, yet inside we know it's tearing Earth's life apart. Our whole system seems to be built on dwindling fossil energy, pollution, economic bubbles, maybe fraud. Now, what are we going to do? Well, looking for answers, we find Carolyn Baker. She's been a psychotherapist and adjunct professor of psychology and history. Carolyn has been searching ahead since at least the 1990s. Her latest book is Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. From Boulder, Colorado, Carolyn, it's a treat to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
What moved you from academia to the study of social breakdown and rejuvenation?
Well, it was a real easy transition because during my time as an adjunct professor of history, I increasingly began to look at where Western civilization was going, is going. And it was very clear to me that we were confronting a triple crisis, a convergence of crises between energy depletion, environmental devastation, and economic meltdown, and other issues in there as well that are related to all three. So it was quite a natural transition because one fed into the other.
And I was struck by an article you posted in April of last year titled, Economic Recovery, No Thank You. Why would you say that?
Well, because our economic model in Western civilization is based on unlimited growth. And that is, by definition, unsustainable. So what we've come up against in this unlimited growth model is a brick wall, which is because of economic, meltdown, energy depletion, and environmental devastation, not allowing us to continue with unlimited growth. Unlimited growth is part of what has been destroying us and the Earth community. So I don't want to go back to that model. I want to be part of finding a new model that is based on sustainability and based on connection with the Earth community.
I have to agree with you with regrets. On our program, we recently had Tim Garrett, the scientist from the University of Utah, and he was explaining we either collapse the fossil economy or we face deadly climate change. But that could be more long-term, and I wonder, do you think peak oil could bring us down first?
Well, actually, what I think is bringing us down first is the economic crisis, which is worldwide. We're looking now at, the dissolution of the dollar. We're looking at ghastly amounts of debt and nations defaulting on their debts. I don't know where this is all going to go, but I know it's not going anywhere good. And many people in the peak oil movement thought that, peak oil would be the first aspect of this collapse. And it turns out that the economic issues came first, although they are very connected with peak oil. It's really hard to say, you know, which one is going to come first or how that's going to play out, because they're all so connected.
Well, certainly the idea of $147 a barrel oil, just the idea of it, shocked a lot of Americans and people around the world into realizing that this isn't an infinite resource. So we may be entering an age of disappointment. The dream is falling apart. Previous expectations won't be met. How can people cope or even turn this to their advantage?
Well, that's the topic and the focus of my book and of the upcoming course that I'm going to be teaching for post-peak living, which the name of the course is entitled Navigating the Coming Chaos. And, you know, the point of writing my book and teaching this course is to assist people in looking deeper than this economic model of unlimited growth and the American dream and owning the house and, you know, the three SUVs and all of these things that industrial civilization has told us we have to have in order to be meaningful human beings, to be, you know, to take our place on the planet, to have a good life. And so, you know, it is through the collapse, I believe, that we're then forced back in within ourselves and to our community, our small communities, our local place, to reconnect with very different values.
You know, it's strange. When you talk like that, something that just came to my mind as I'm looking around my studio area here, almost all of our furniture is used furniture. And it's not necessarily because we're super poor people, but it just seems like it's foolish to go out and ask somebody to cut down even more rainforest to make us some furniture. So do you think that this change of people's expectations will help?
Absolutely, because we're going to be forced to learn skills that are foreign to us at the present time, although some people are starting to learn some of those skills, you know, and live more in a manner that our grandparents and great-grandparents and other ancestors lived, using things fully before throwing them away and considering very carefully what we do want to purchase and how we're going to use it and why we're going to use it. So, you know, I think that's just one of the possible upsides of this collapse process.
And you've been one of the leading advocates of local action and transition towns. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I'm working very closely with Transition Colorado here in Boulder, contributing to their new online newspaper called Transition Times, which is right now the Colorado edition, but it covers all aspects of transition worldwide, and anyone can read it on the internet. And one of the focuses here in Boulder is the Eat Local Resource Campaign, which is inviting people to make a 10% shift in eating locally, purchasing locally in terms of food. We have a very strong consciousness here in Boulder County of the importance of local food. And I go on the internet every day for my daily news digest to gather and bundle news stories. And you know, everywhere I go, I'm seeing stories about food crisis. In fact, there was a story today on Common Dreams. I think it was called Another Summer, Another Food Crisis. Food, I believe, is going to be the new oil. It's going to be the new gold of the next generation.
How would people tune into your daily news items?
Simply by going to my website, www.carolynbaker.net. And over on the left-hand corner is a big green button that says click. It's for subscribing to the Daily News Digest. The Daily News Digest is published 7 days a week throughout the year unless I'm traveling or just absolutely unavailable, which is rare. And what I do is I carefully gather and bundle the news that is related to collapse issues as well as stories that present options for navigating those changes, and it's based on a subscription model based on a sliding scale. Many, many people say that they can't live without it, they're addicted to it, they get up every morning and eat their breakfast with a Daily News Digest, and it's kind of created for many people a sense of online community. I'm not alone, you know, and it's very validating to see these stories every day along with the options.
Friends, we're talking with Carolyn Baker. I am intrigued by this new course you talk about because it's something they don't teach in the Harvard Business School, that's for sure. So,
right. And
you're going to do it online so people don't have to drive somewhere and create greenhouse gases and waste all that
right. Money.
How is that online teaching going to work?
Well, the way it's going to work is we're going to start on Saturday, April 24th. It's a course that is a duration of 3 hours. I believe it starts at 10 a.m. Pacific time and runs until 1 o'clock with a couple of five-minute breaks. And there's lots of time for discussion and interaction by phone. It's not going to be online chat. It's going to be live conversation by telephone. People can talk with me and with each other, and then I will be available for one-on-one consultation between sessions if people are interested. But that is April 24th, May 1st, May 8th, and May 15th. And to find out more and or to register, people should go to www.postpeakliving.com. And there is a considerable discount in registration fee if one registers by April 10th.
I want to move on to another problem here. How do we get beyond ideas and get past the endless online attractions to do something real in our community?
Well, a lot of people have discovered that that is much more rewarding. Many people who are involved in transition and other organizations are realizing that this whole model of bigger is better and everything must be global, everything must be national, is also unsustainable in that what is happening as these systems deteriorate is that we're realizing things have to become local and changes have to be made on the local level. That is not to say we should ignore the issues that are affecting people on the other side of the world, because in fact we are all connected. But the real solutions or the real options are going to have to be in our local place.
Well, yes, and I think the emphasis has to be on the word community, because as we learned in that book, Bowling Alone, that we've become so individuated and we don't have that much face time with others. And for many people, the religious groups have fallen apart. So it's going to be a real challenge to build up new lines of community.
Well, it is. And I think that as things get more dire, we will be forced to plug into our community, create community with each other. You know, I hear a lot of stories of people who have had experiences with living in eco-villages or trying to create intentional communities, and you know, there's been so much conflict, and they've sort of walked away saying, oh, man, community doesn't work. Don't even tell me about it. And I think that perhaps one of the reasons for that is that right now creating that kind of close community is sort of a luxury. But as these systems fall apart and we are forced back on, you know, interdepending on each other, some of those nitpicky things that keep us from really coming together will pale by comparison with the need that we have to be interdependent.
You know, we just had an odd experience here in Vancouver. The Olympics were here, and hundreds of thousands of people came out into the streets and sort of ran into each other almost for the first time. There were no protests. It wasn't a police action. In fact, people were giving the police big hugs. So I think that there was an idea there that we can get away from our TVs and meet each other again.
Absolutely. And that will become even more real as we don't have television because we may not have the energy resources to keep them happening, or we may not have the money to pay for cable or whatever. I see the television as something that's a luxury that we can have right now, but we're not going to have it forever. And then what will we do? You know, we can only read so many books. But the point is, we need each other. Nobody in this collapse is going to survive on his or her own. Isolation and rugged individualism is a recipe for death. So we're only going to be able to survive if we become interdependent.
That's something I really like about your work, because your vision seems a lot bigger than digging a concrete hole and filling it full of food, guns, and gold.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What is real survival about?
Real survival is about not only the technological or the logistic preparation, and this is what I really, really emphasize in my book and in this course. We have got to prepare on other levels besides storing the food, storing the water, relearning the skills, all of which are extremely important. But we've got to prepare emotionally and spiritually. And as you begin to envision or imagine a world in collapse where we don't have these resources, we don't have money as we know it, we don't have energy, we don't have all of these things, it's going to be a chaotic world. It's going to be a scary world for many people. And so how are we going to navigate that emotionally with all of the feelings of loss coming up, or the feelings of fear, or the feelings of grief? You know, how do we prepare for those feelings? Because we will feel them.
You do talk about dark emotions. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't consider any emotion particularly dark, but, you know, we've come to think of emotions like grief and fear and despair and, of course, anger as dark. And there's a wonderful book written by a psychologist named Miriam Greenspan entitled Healing Through the Dark Emotions. And I'm going to be using some of her material in my Sacred Demise Level 2 workshop. I'm in the process of creating Levels 1, 2, and 3. These are workshops that I do in different places, not the same as the course that I'm going to be teaching, where we can really face those emotions instead of running from them as most people are doing now, and in that way become more prepared for when those feelings are perhaps more frequent in our world.
I wonder, a lot of this transition planning and action depends on timing. There could be grave penalties for people who don't prepare, but there can be downsides to moving too soon as well. I mean, what if the fossil empire just keeps adding patches and faking it and limps along for the rest of our lifetimes?
You know, that brings up a good point, which is that I think that collapse is going to be both slow and fast. Some people say, well, how long is this going to, you know, is this going to happen quickly or slowly? And I say, yes, it's going to happen in both ways, because I think that it really will be, as James Howard Kunstler says, a long emergency. Loss here and loss there and collapse here and collapse there. But I think there will also be tipping points and serious, immediate kinds of crises like Katrina, like the Chilean earthquake that we just recently witnessed in Haiti, that will move the collapse process along faster. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of limping along for a while, and that's really concerning, because the longer the empire limps along, the more devastation to the environment, and I think to our human souls.
As we wrap up, Carolyn Baker, we have barely scratched the surface of your work and thought. Could you tell us just a couple of the other questions that you might be wrestling with these days?
Well, I think that many people who in the United States were very hopeful about a new candidate of a different party, the first black man in the White House, and all of the hope and change that were promised in the campaign for president, many progressives and people who are concerned about the environment were certainly hoping that this would make it a huge difference. And now most of those folks are confronting, well, a real disappointment, because I call it Bush 3. I call it the hopium has worn off. And so a lot of folks are saying, so what do we do now? And I wrote an article a couple of months ago, which you can find on my website, called Your Disappointment in Obama is Your Teaching Moment. So it's now an opportunity to come back and look at, what is hope? Well, hope is something that I generate within myself. It's not something that somebody else can give to me. And all of these problems that we're confronting are not about some government, some candidate, some president making it better. It's about us tapping into our inner resources and to coming together with our community to solve these issues or address these issues and respond to them on a local level.
And this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with one of the thought leaders of the coming decade, Carolyn Baker. You will probably want her book, Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. Check out her website at carolynbaker.net and look into her online course about preparing for these transition times. Thank you, Carolyn, and I hope you'll join us again.
I certainly will. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex. This is Radio EcoShock, trying hard to be a world-class English language show. Last week we heard from Australia, of course we do American, and listeners from the UK, you are our number three audience. Now it is Canada's turn, and what a black eye for the beaver tails. While his government was full of green promises, Prime Minister Stephen Harper has been caught slashing climate research funds, appointing climate deniers to key government funding positions, and, just like in the dark old Bush days, scheming to muzzle the country's top climate scientists. Here is independent journalist Stephen Leahy interviewing Graham Saul of Climate Action Network.
You're saying that the federal government is stacking boards with people they know are denying climate change is happening?
Yeah, I'm saying that, so the Prime Minister's appointed what we would consider three climate change skeptics to boards of the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council and the Canada Foundation for Innovation. And the three individuals' views are pretty much completely at odds with the international scientific consensus on climate change and the views expressed by the government's own ministers.
So these are not scientists that are being appointed to these boards as well?
They're in the report itself. Let me see. So Christopher Essex, a professor and associate chair in the Department of Applied Mathematics at University of Waterloo and former director of its program in theoretical physics. So that sounds like a scientist. In 2002, he wrote a book with Ross McKittrick entitled Taken by Storm, which attempted to challenge the, quote, myth of climate change. And on November 2nd, 2006, he was appointed to the board of the NSERC.
Actually, I know this guy. This guy has sent me emails pointing out the errors in my
stories. So there's him. There's Mark Mullins, who holds a PhD in economics from the London School of Economics and was the executive director of the Fraser Institute, a free market think tank. Between 2003 and 2004, he received $120,000 from ExxonMobil. The Fraser Institute received over $120,000 from ExxonMobil. And he was appointed to the board of the NSERC in 2009. And John Weisenberger holds a PhD in geology from the University of Calgary and has worked in the oil and gas industry, notably Husky Energy in Alberta, for over 20 years. He's a friend of Prime Minister Harper and a former chief of staff in his government, and he was appointed to the board of directors of Canada Foundation for Innovation.
Now, do any of these boards provide funding for climate science in Canada?
Yes. I mean, in the report, there are specific quotes from some of these folks, like Mark Mullins. The climate change issue is somewhat sensational and definitely exaggerated. It strikes me that the science is not settled. Christopher Ethics and Ross McKittrick, the claim that there is a global warming crisis threatening to bring chaos and destruction upon the world is so feeble you were probably feeling skeptical anyways. You were right. Yeah, so these bodies are responsible for providing funding and oversight on climate change research, among other things.
Okay, so this is just one piece of evidence you feel that shows that the federal government is not taking climate change seriously?
Yeah, and the report demonstrates a pattern that includes, as I said, stacking boards responsible for oversight over science with climate change skeptics. It includes policies that effectively muzzle climate change scientists working for Environment Canada, being able to effectively engage the press, and as a result, their engagement with the news media has plummeted over the course of the period that was studied, which was 2007 to 2008. It includes burying reports by releasing them at strange hours after paying consultants significant amounts of money to prepare communication strategies that were then ignored. and it includes allowing funding for key bodies to expire and bringing into question whether or not those bodies would provide essential climate change research will continue.
Give me an example on the funding issue.
Yeah, specifically we're talking about the Canadian Foundation of Climate and Atmospheric Science. So in its 2010 budget, the Government of Canada refused to provide new funds to the Canadian Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Science, which is in many ways the most important funding body for university-based research on climate science in Canada. And our analysis shows that the government's abandonment of CFCAS will likely result in total federal funding for university-based climate science research, excluding infrastructure, falling to less than half of the level at which it has been for the past several years.
Is that for 2010 or is that for the future?
That's for starting in 2011. Basically, they're out of money and they can't make new commitments.
So they cannot engage in new research programs or...
Yeah, over the course of this year, if they're going to be getting ready to do work next year, they don't have any money for it. Basically, they requested additional money for this budget so that they could ensure continuity in the programs, and they didn't get it.
So programs they have running right now will be terminated?
Yeah, if there's not additional money. I mean, they will not be able to continue with scientific research that is currently happening.
All right. You mentioned also policy of muzzling climate scientists. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, in 2007, Environment Canada brought in a new communications policy that required everybody to go through the communications department. And what they found was that requests from journalists for information on climate science related issues were going unanswered. Scientists were trying to run requests through the communications department. The communications department wasn't getting back to them. So we have this document that demonstrates that one person argues that they had forwarded as much as 30 requests for science interviews to the media relations department, that the approvals to proceed was granted for only about 20% of the cases. In some cases, leading Environment Canada climate change scientists were being denied the opportunity to talk to journalists. In other cases, the responses were just taking so long that they weren't able to respond to the request in time for the deadlines that journalists were working under. And as a result, media coverage of climate change science reduced by over 80% between 2007 and 2008.
Okay, so you're saying that media coverage in Canada of climate change science, is this just from Environment Canada scientists or just climate change science in general?
Environment Canada. A review of the coverage received in Environment Canada media clippings database over the period January to September indicates that for their three highest profile climate change scientists, media coverage decreased sharply from 2007 to 2008.
Who are those three?
I don't think it says in this document.
Because I can't name three myself, actually.
Yeah, I don't think it says it in this document, so I don't know.
And I write about climate change all the time, which perhaps is a good indicator. What does this mean to the Canadian public? I mean, this what you say is going on?
Well, it says that this government is essentially launching an attack on climate science, as far as I'm concerned. There's a broader pattern here where you've got former ministers questioning the science of climate change in major Canadian newspapers, and you've got a government that is effectively doing nothing on climate change. So it says that they don't take this issue seriously, and it brings into question whether or not they actually believe their own rhetoric in terms of the need to take action on climate change. It appears to me that they're, in one form or another, burying the truth, whether that's by making it difficult for Environment Canada climate change scientists to talk to the journalists, or it's cutting back on the amount of resources the scientists have to produce good information, or it's burying reports as they come out rather than giving them the profile that they deserve.
Now, why do you think the government is burying the truth about climate change?
Well, I think the government has decided that they intend to do nothing until they're forced to do something. This government has put forward a series of promises. A pattern has developed where the government says it's going to do something about the problem and then it proceeds to do nothing. And then a year later, it says it's going to do something about the problem and then it proceeds to do nothing. And now it's basically openly saying that it has no intention of regulating Canadian industry until the United States does, when the United States is actually moving forward in other ways, including climate change science and investment in renewable energy, currently outspending Canada 14 times to 1 per capita. terms of investments in renewable energy. So it's a pattern, it's a broader pattern of a government that isn't taking this file seriously. It seems to be, to some degree at least, linked to the fact that they're intent on ensuring that Canadian energy resources, especially the tar sands, emerge unfettered and that growth occurs.
So you're saying that Canadians won't be, Canada won't be moving into a green economy?
Well, I mean, the budget talks, right? The budget is a concrete opportunity for the government to make commitments to create clean energy jobs. And what we saw in the last budget was that this government has no intention of positioning the Canadian economy to be a player in the clean energy economy of the 21st century. There was, you know, the budget was shocking in terms of its total failure to think strategically about how Canada can invest in and benefit from the clean energy economy. That's not happening in the United States. It's not happening in Europe. Those countries are positioning themselves to be leaders in these fields. And it's clear that right now the Canadian government is saying we have no intention of regulating industry. We're not investing in clean energy jobs. And now what we're seeing is that they're also muzzling scientists and making it difficult for good climate science to emerge.
So what's going to be the impact on the Canadian public?
To the degree that this inhibits the Canadian public's access to quality scientific information, then it's going to play the role of dumbing down the debate. I mean, the reality is that there are national academies of science. There is no real debate about humans causing climate change. What we're seeing right now is that the more the government engages in activity that makes it difficult for leading climate change scientists to speak open to the public, the more room it leaves for other people to come in and occupy that space. So, unfortunately, it means that the Canadians are going to be less informed about one of the most urgent issues facing the world today.
Graham, you're with the Climate Action Network, right?
Yeah, Climate Action Network Canada.
And Climate Action Network Canada is?
It's a coalition of leading Canadian organizations working together to push for action on climate change, about 60 organizations.
Okay, great. Well, thanks very much, Graham. I appreciate your help.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Lay interviewing Graham Saul at Climate Action Network. Find their report, Troubling Evidence, the Harper Government's Approach to Climate Science Research in Canada, by Andrew Cuddy, as a free PDF download at climateactionnetwork.ca. This was edited for radio by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Go to stephenlahey.com, that's LEAHY.com. Ugly stuff. Canwest ran a story saying climate coverage from government scientists was down 80%, since Mr. Tar Sands went to work in the Canadian capital. And expensive reports get released at crazy hours after the press is gone. Anything to sweep it all under the rug while our north melts, while our species go under. The rest of the planet doesn't get to find out what is happening in the Great White North, in one of the largest and most heavily impacted parts of the globe.
But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right.
You tell them, George Carlin. That's it for me this week. We opened with a song from 350.org, 350, The People's Priority, by Daisy May and Seth Bernard. We'll go out with another 350 Get Down with May Earlwine.
350, let me hear you if you're with me. Ain't it sweet? Get down with 350.
Well, it's time for us humans to open our eyes, and it should come as no surprise that the natural natural world has been compromised by the Industrial Revolution. Instead of sustainable solutions, we've been burning coal and sucking up oil, polluting the air and the water, the soil. The amount of carbon in the atmosphere has gone beyond what we can endure. 350 parts per million, that's the number we need. And right now we're pushing 390.